civil priority. Isolation now in effect. To avoid the risk of contamination, please stay indoors and await further instructions.
Well, good morning, Tribe World. It's Ray here. I hope you're all doing well in these strange and unpredictable, difficult times. It's a pleasure to bring you another lockdown podcast. And I'm joined now by a tremendous young man, a very talented and gifted filmmaker, as well as a wonderful actor who brought to life one of your very favorite characters within our Tribe fandom, Jay. And so join me in welcoming James Napier Robinson. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Ray. Lovely to speak to you again after what has been a little while. So just great to reconnect.
Lovely to hear your voice as well, James. And you're up in Auckland in your bubble?
Yes, I'm safely tucked away in my Western Springs bubble in Auckland. I feel pretty lucky to be in New Zealand with my wife and two young children as we ride out this very, very strange time for the world.
That's right. And James, a lot of your fans will be fascinated to know that since the Tribe, you've become a dad, as you say, and
yeah. You've
got two children, one 3 and 18 months, yeah?
That's right, yeah. He's actually, I've got a little boy and he's 3, but he is turning 4 in about a week and a half, which he is extremely excited about and is having dreams of getting a new toy Red Hulk on his birthday, which I think might just come true. And then our little girl, Sophia, who is 18 months, and she's doing wonderfully.
Now is she, James? She's walking around or?
Well, you know what? She should be. She should be walking, but she's taking her time. She's quite happy crawling around still. So, you know, we're waiting any day now for her to take her first steps.
And how have you been passing the time, James, with the lockdown? And you're obviously able to write and work from home. And are you able to do that?
So, you know, it's an interesting thing, sort of having the two young kids at home, because I have to sort of fit my working time around also helping with them. My wife is she's a pianist and a musician, and she actually composed the score for the last movie that I made. And so, you know, I try and help her. We sort of juggle. So I get up very early in the morning. My routine is I get up even as early as 3:30 in the morning so that I can try and get a full day's writing in by about midday, and then I can kind of sub in and relieve my wife of child care duty so she can go and compose some music and do her kind of thing, and then we sort of tag team at the end to make it through the day. So that's sort of what our days look like.
That's fascinating. And James, a lot of your fans will obviously be aware that, as well as being a very gifted writer and director and actor, that you and Tom worked together on The Dark Horse, which was a tremendously successful film. And James, had you always wanted to direct? I mean, how did that all come about?
I think because I started, like Tom, you know, I started acting at, you know, pretty young age. Well, of course, like all of your actors in the Tribe, really, you sort of had so many actors that, you know, came into acting in their early teens or you know, maybe even younger. Well, actually, definitely, certainly younger for some of them. And so I kind of, you know, I was acting straight out of school, and I think, but probably initially more than directing, I was also doing quite a bit of writing, and I reached a point where I'd done a lot of acting and I'd sort of enjoyed that, but I think I kind of hungered for to be part of the storytelling side of it, and not that actors aren't of course such a huge part of telling the story, but I think you know, there is a very special thing when you when you get to write something and then direct it and see it through and really, you know, create a world, as you well know, Ray, as you did it to a huge degree with not only The Tribe, but your other shows. And so probably it was in my early 20s, I think, when I was starting to seriously try and figure out how I could sort of you know, evolve from just acting into making films. And I made a bunch of short films, and I would use sort of the money that I was earning as an actor to pay for them and to buy equipment, editing equipment and camera gear. And I would shoot these shorts. Tom was in one of them, and I would often act in them, but I found that more and more I just yearned to be able to not act in them and to just find other, you know, find great actors to be in them and to stay behind the camera. And so eventually that sort of, after enough short films, Tom, funnily enough, I was actually living in LA and trying to get a feature film made there for a script that I'd co-written with someone over there. And we were really struggling. And then Tom was over on a trip and we went out, we caught up, and he said that he wanted to produce a film. And I didn't actually know that. And he said he wanted to produce something and wanted me to direct it. And that was from, you know, us having kind of done a couple of short films together. And so I had this script and I said, look, I've been trying to get this, you know, going here in the States, but I'm really struggling. And he read it and said, well, what if we tried to get it made in New Zealand? And so that was pretty much what became the first feature film that Tom and I did together, which was called I'm Not Harry Jensen, which is an extremely hard title to remember, we've realized in hindsight, but it seemed good at the time. And that was all set, you know, we did it on a very low budget. It was just money that we could raise by going around. And I think I'd read that the Coen brothers got their first movie financed by shooting a kind of fake trailer that they did, you know, and then they would screen that for people, and they would actually look up D for dentist in the phone book and show up at their house and be like, do you want to be a producer on a movie? And they would play this trailer in their lounge and then raise the money and made Blood Simple their first film like that. So we kind of tried to do that, really. I shot this trailer and we sort of played it to a bunch of people and raised a bit of money and managed to go out and make the movie.
And I have to say, James, it's terrific that that showed your that there was some great things ahead for you, because I saw that. And if any of the fans have a chance to check it out, you should, because it really is terrific. And it's the acorns, it's the seeds that have been planted for both Tom and James, who are tremendously talented people and very gifted. And you'll see, you know, see the genesis there. And that was an amazing achievement. How long did it take you to make it, James?
Well, you know, it's funny, because when you're doing, especially, you know, your first feature film, and it's like this with your first short film and with anything, really, you're really figuring it out as you go along. You don't have, you know, much experience to draw on, but you do have a lot of passion and determination, which is a great sort of substitute for having any money to make it with. So we kind of, you know, I wrote the script, and once Tom said, let's do this back in New Zealand, I had to kind of rewrite the script to create it in New Zealand. And we did it, you know, there were a couple of things we did as well, where it's like, it's very actor driven. It's out in the bush in the Waitakere Ranges in New Zealand, which is this beautiful landscape, but thankfully, you know, it doesn't cost much to shoot there. So it's a way of trying to make the movie feel bigger than it is. And I spent probably, I can't, you know, years really writing that script. And I think I started writing it when I was 22, and I think we shot when I was 25. So, you know, quite a bit of time trying to figure out how to tell that story. And then the actual shoot itself was about 16 days because we had no money, and we was meant to be 18 days, I think, but we got 2 days rained out. And so, You know, I remember going into it, I had all these storyboards and, you know, shots planned of all these sort of things I was going to do. And every day it just reached a point where I'd just have to throw that out and just shoot as fast as I could and focus on trying to get good performances from the actors and tell the story in the most, you know, quick but sort of effective way possible. And then I think when it came to editing it, again, you know, we didn't really know, we had an editor, but he sort of struggled with it. And I think I shot a lot of footage and he hadn't even gone through it all and we realized it. So I'd edited the short films that I'd made, but I just was like, at that point, I need to edit this if we're going to get it made because we don't have any money. So I kind of had to teach myself how to edit that movie. I'd always edited on different software that's sort of cheaper and more easily available, whereas this was professional editing software that I had to quickly try and learn. And I think I cut it for a year, maybe longer. And then we sort of got it into some festivals but you really do learn as you go. That's the only way to do it.
I think it's a wonderful achievement, James, and you should be very proud of it. And The Dark Horse, of course, is amazing and very successful. And we, in Tom's podcast, we were explaining to the tribal fans to really try and check it out. And it's available all over the world on probably Netflix and different platforms. And I can't recommend it highly enough. And I was, before we started recording, mentioning to James, who knows my grandson and is evolving and will become a bit of a mentor, I think, to my grandson. And he wants to be a filmmaker, and in his top 10 movies is James and Tom's The Dark Horse. And that's from a very critical, cynical young talent. not because of any friendship that we have. I mean, literally, it's just a wonderful piece of work, James.
Thank you so much, Ray.
You miss acting? I mean, will you ever act again, do you think? Or?
It's funny, you know, in all honesty, I don't really find myself missing acting much. You know, one of the reasons might be that when I'm writing, I get to act a lot because I'm sort of acting out all the characters as I'm writing them. So I kind of, in my own little, you know, bubble, I guess, I get that. But it's also, I guess it's a, I don't know how else to put it. It's sort of a personality thing, I guess. I've never really enjoyed the spotlight in that way. I think I always felt kind of uncomfortable, being sort of a performer front and center in that sense. I loved acting at times and I had some wonderful experiences doing it, but I think I found that my connection with writing and directing and editing and storytelling in that sense, I just had a deeper, richer connection with it. And I think I can't do both. Certainly some people can and they do it very well, and I just don't think I'm one of those people. I think I have to kind of choose between the two because I need to put my full focus and attention on whatever the thing is that I'm doing, otherwise I won't do it well enough, I won't be good enough. So I have to kind of zero in on that.
Very creative being, James. And had you always been that as a boy? Did you like stories and writing and music and arts when you were young growing up?
Yeah, I think I did. But I was also a very shy kid when I was younger. So I didn't kind of put myself out there that much when I was younger. And then when I was about 13, I remember I went to high school for the first year, and my sister, who was a few years older than me, she was a much more kind of confident, vibrant personality. And I think probably in some ways when we were growing up, she often really wanted that spotlight. So I was quite kind of happy to let her have it and sort of sit back more. And then she was doing school shows the kind of school productions, and she sort of dragged me along to these auditions for the school show that she was going to do. And so I remember being terrified about the thought of auditioning for this, and it was Grease, the musical. And so I then got kind of pulled in by my sister, and I did this audition, and I think I could sort of sing was really probably the only thing that everything else I felt kind of terrified about doing, but I sang a little bit. And and then I got offered this role to play Teen Angel. Was so it was like a character who, he's not one of the lead roles, but he kind of comes in and he sings this song. I think his name is Teen Angel. And he has one song, and it's like about beauty school dropout. And so it was like, all I had to do is I had to be able to sing that one song. And I remember getting offered the role, and I went away and I thought about it. And I just went, I can't do this. I'm too terrified of getting up and singing a song in front of an audience. So I turned it down. And right. And they got really annoyed at me. But what I said was I would be one of the greasers. So those are just one of the guys who's part of Danny Zuko's crew. And I would kind of sing with about five or six other guys. And that was what I felt I was up for. And so even that, I remember every time I'd walk out on stage, just this feeling of kind of terror. But I got used to it. So I did that show, and I began to just get a little bit more confident, I guess, at going out on stage. So the next year I did the school show, and this time I did a bigger role and that had its own solo moment. And then the following year, and it's just kind of evolved like that. And eventually, you know, I started auditioning and doing TV work, and that was really what led me into it.
Isn't that interesting? So would you describe yourself still as a shy person, James? Are you quite shy?
I think now I'm not shy in that sense, but I am very private. I'm not kind of someone that, you know, longs for attention or to be sort of, you know, like I think I said to you before we started, Ray, I'm not on social media really. I don't. Other than I have a Facebook account, but I very rarely use it. But I'm probably not. I think, and I would credit that to being an actor. One of the things about it is you're forced to pretend to be confident even when you're not. In a way, you have to start performing when someone says action or step out on stage. And so I kind of got used to, it's almost like fake it until you make it, that sort of thing. I got used to pretending like I was confident. And eventually I think, you know, that you really can start feeling, you know, confident. You don't have to pretend as much, but I still, you know, if I have to, you know, go out and give a speech to lots of people, or if I'm, you know, I still definitely will get, you know, nerves like anyone else would. And
That's very interesting, actually. It's funny because, you know, when you first came into my life and we first met, and I remember once you were joking about my office like a rainforest. Do you remember, James?
How could I forget?
Yeah, that's absolutely. Something that's,
I still dream of the day I can have a rainforest office like you did, Ray. That was really, really
great. I love the elements, and James was laughing at once he came into my office. For me, it's normal. You know, where the whole ceiling is all plants and
your clocks. You had a world clock for each time zone. I remember it was such a
and fountain, the sound of water and you struck me, James, as quite confident. You had a nice self-assurance and a nice dignity, and that's why the character of Jay, you know, who different to Ram, of course, but this kind of leader, this self-assurance, and that's what I liked. It wasn't like a confidence where it's over the top, like brazen Lex, very, very out there, very arrogant almost at times, but your character, and you seem to possess this interesting, you know, my observation of you when I first met you. I thought this is an unusual young man. I could notice the differences there, you know, very, very creative. And I think you're a very gifted actor, I have to say. I think it's a shame if you don't do any more acting, but I can totally understand with your flair for the directing and the passion for that and the writing. And James, do you have a love-hate thing with writing? Do you find it easy? Are you able to, is it perspiration or inspiration?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure you know all about it, but I mean, it's both. It's all really. I love writing, and I love, you know, I think probably one of the things that I love about writing is that the job requires you to learn. You know, you can't write about something unless you know about it, and whether that is a specific world that you're writing about or whether it's just literally trying to understand more the psychology of a person or a character and how they would react in a given situation. I love that kind of thing, and I feel very lucky that in a way by being a writer and a storyteller, it's allowed me to grow as a human being in a way that I don't know that I would have if it wasn't for that. And I think that again, you know, as I say, and it's very nice of you to say, you know, those compliments about when we first met, you know, but it's interesting when you're younger. I certainly remember as well, like, you're figuring the world out and you're figuring yourself out. And I think it's a very kind of, can be a very confusing time. And I think that, you know, insecurities can be rife, and you sort of, you want to try and present yourself as something, but you often feel you're not that, or you're, you know, and the life of an actor is a very, I really applaud actors for what they go through. And I think it's a very unstable life for a lot of actors, because they are their product in a way. They're having to constantly put themselves out there. And I think it's a very tricky thing to stay grounded with that. So I do feel fortunate to be able to kind of be grounded through the work that I get to do.
That's so fascinating. I mean, anybody that creates anything, I have the utmost love and respect and admiration. You know, people that can write or compose music, like your lovely, lovely partner, your wife, who can compose music or stories or paint, or anybody that can bring something into in existence, it's like a brotherhood and a sisterhood, because we know that pain. I mean, and as you say, yeah, I look at it like a self-inflicted nervous breakdown, James, you know.
I couldn't agree more. And yeah, back to your question of, do I find it writing challenge or perspiration or inspiration? I mean, I find writing incredibly hard, you know, incredibly hard. And I find that it's every script, especially, you know, it can take a long time, and it can feel like you're struggling for so much of that. And I think, you know, you have to be very thick-skinned as well, because you can, you know, have something that you've worked on for so long and tried so hard with, and then you reread it after a break and you go, gosh, this isn't as good as I thought it was, or just it's further away from where it needs to be than I thought it was. And I have to kind of take that on the chin and sort of stay humble and start from scratch again, or just reapproach it. And, you know, I'm sort of, I think that, you know, there's some sort of balance that people have talked about of 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. And I'd say that's pretty true.
Yeah, I think so too. And a lot of our tribal fans, they do fan fiction, they write, they are very creative. Many want to get in the business. There's a lot that will find your this talk today very interesting as well, James. You know, people are always thinking, how we get a lot of emails and wondering, how do I get into the business? I want to do this, I want to do that. But it's a heartbreak business. It's a hard business. But it's like a niche. that you have to scratch. If you're creative, you have to do it. It's a calling, isn't it?
It is. And I think, again, it's like, you know, for all those people that are figuring out how to get in or that they want to do it, it's funny because there's no one path and there's no one right way of doing it. It's really the number one thing, I think, is doing it because you love it. And if you do love it, then you will keep doing it, whether or not it kind of, you sort of quote unquote breakthrough or, you know, it's that passion is what drives it. And I think that's probably a good thing for people to remember, you know, is I would strongly say, write what you feel passionate about. Don't try and write or make something that you think you're doing because you think it might be what could be successful or get you, you know, make you break through. That won't really probably be the real you that's coming through in that. And so instead, it's trying to really listen to yourself and who you are and the things you're interested in. Trust that those things will be of interest to other people. And it doesn't matter how sort of esoteric or obscure those might be, whatever it is that you are interested in as a person, that's what you should then want to tell a story about. And that way that passion will mean that I can't count the number of times where I've gone to bed feeling a little bit kind of worn out and beaten by everything, but I wake up in the morning and I just sort of make a coffee and sit down and keep going and go at it again, because I'm passionate about the thing I'm doing. It doesn't mean that by the end of it, I don't also utterly hate it because I've been working on it for so long and I'm just worn out by the thing I'm working on and wondering. I remember with the Dark Horse, the pretty much the final draft that I wrote of it, which was pretty much the script that we shot for the movie. When I emailed that to Tom, I think my email content, I basically said, I give up, I've failed, let's talk. And I attached the script. And Tom then, and I meant it. I remember feeling beaten. I just was like, I don't know what else to do. I haven't got there and I'm exhausted and help, you know, I don't know what to do. And then Tom called me and he was like, I think this is it. I think we're ready, you know? And I was like, really? And that was the movie, you know? So that's how hard it can push you, you know?
It's beautifully written, James. It's a lovely script and beautifully put together. But I mean, some of the advice I give as well, James, is I think fundamentally, I mean, what we're talking about is, it's almost like contentment. You'll never find contentment in anything unless it's within yourself. You can't find it with money or Academy Awards or booze or drugs or whatever. It's happiness. And likewise for your creative, you've got to be pleased and happy with what you're doing. And it's interesting, you know, that I think the first thing is to love your brothers and sisters around the world. Love that creative process, respect the creative process. And I mean, I'm often saying to my grandson, who is this all cynical, all critical, which is right, and I understand that. But, you know, I mean, the pain of filling blank pages is amazing. And I'm some people that write fan fiction, I notice, I mean, they'll critique something and give something one star. And I think that's crazy, you know, rather than to embrace the beauty of somebody being able to create something. And writing, everything else is interpretive, and there's a creative element, but they're creating or they're interpreting something a writer has created, really. And it starts on that blank page. It's composing music. It's amazing. But it is that love hate. I love thinking about it, and I hate doing it. And then once I do it, James, I mean, and again, I don't mean to bore the listeners, but when I was young at the BBC and I struggled writing a series, and every word was like pulling teeth, and my wife would be saying, what the hell? I'd be pacing around anguished, and I was all tormented. And she'd say, why are you doing this to yourself? And I said, because I love it. You know, I couldn't understand. It was like a masochist, you know. And when I went to the BBC and an actor wanted to change one word, and I just went bananas. You know? I felt like I've struggled for months to get that one word. It's just, it's not vanity. It's not me thinking it's a terrific word, but it's that passion, you know. It's when you struggle, it's the scars, it's the, you know, stories and that are seared or, you know, forged from the scars in your soul, you know. It's just pain.
That's exactly right. I think it's though, and those are the kind of life lessons that, that you're speaking of that you've learned that actually go into your work. They inform your voice and the way you, you know, your worldview and the way you sort of want to tell that particular story. And I think, or any story. And I think that's a really important thing, again, for anyone trying to do anything, whether it's writing or any kind of creative venture, is to just be sort of be kind to themselves and listen to themselves and try and turn down the voice that's constantly judging themselves, and instead just sort of give yourself a hug and kind of go, okay, who am, like, what am I interested in, who am I, and how do I want to tell something? And I think also understand that it's okay to struggle and find it hard, and it's okay to think that maybe your work's no good. I think I'm always riddled with, I remember that, you know, with the two feature films that I've made, before you shoot them, you do a cast read through, and everyone sits around in a circle and reads this. You'll know this well, Ray, and reads the script. And both times I've done them, when it was Harry Jensen and when it was The Dark Horse, I remember hearing the actors saying it. And I've heard some people say, oh, that's such a wonderful experience, finally hearing your words come to life and actors saying it. I remember I was just sitting there, like, mortified, going, oh, this, it sounds terrible. Like, not them, but my writing. This is just not good enough. Like, these lines are no good. And I've got to, and I remember, like, coming out both times just in a sort of, what feeling wiped out from panic of like, oh my God, you know, what have I got to do? It's just not there yet. And I think probably I'm getting at least more familiar with that feeling, and, you know, but it's sort of, you just keep going, you know, it's, you keep doing it as you're saying. And I think that's the key, is if you're, if you really love it, like you say, you know, you felt with the sort of BBC and when you're writing, and if you know, you'll keep doing it even when it's really hard. And it is often hard.
It is. You just have to, and patience and persistence, never give up and keep going. Yeah, right. And don't take no for an answer. I mean, and James, it's interesting. We were talking before we recorded about, I mean, a lot of the tribal brothers and sisters were always interested about a sequel to The Tribe, or a more particularly a movie. And we can reveal that you and Tom and I had a lovely time on my vineyard. And you'll remember the night where I was joking with Tom, where he was drinking tea and we were drinking a lot of Pinot Noir. talking about, and who knows? I mean, I would love, and we've looked at different ways where we might work together, where Tom might produce and you might direct, write a tribe movie, which to me would be very special for me to pass the baton on to you and Tom, because, you know, I admire you both very much. And James, it's not just talent, it's a spirit. I like to work with certainly talented people, but just, and the viewers and listeners will hear how James is speaking, why he was cast, because you have something that's, it's a unique, I don't know what it is, and you'll know as a director, James, you want somebody, not just talented people, you want somebody who will be there shoulder to shoulder, who believe in what you want to achieve, who you will go on that journey with you, and that's what's special, and you and Tom I hold in very high regard, and I would love you to be with me. It's interesting, you know, I am interested in sailing, and somebody right. sailed around the world. And I was intrigued, you know, my fantasy is I sail around the world. And I said, how was it? And he said, well, I wasn't too worried about the seas or the winds or the weather or Mother Nature. It was the people that were in the boat. And I thought, that's interesting. And I said, so your advice, if you're going to sail around the world, beware of who's in the crew, you know, because right. some people, they might be a terrific sailor, but you want to throw them overboard.
Look, I think that's a great analogy. And I think it's very true. You know, it's funny. I remember the tribe was really the first big role that I did as a young actor. Before that, I'd done kind of supporting roles in a number of different TV shows. And I'd done a lot of theater when I was younger before getting into TV. But the tribe was the first time of, okay, this is really a lead role. And you know, I sort of felt this huge thing of, you know, don't sort of do it well and don't let the show down. And, you know, but it was, so it was this very kind of formative period of my life. And I remember, you know, almost, I feel like I can remember every moment of when I first flew down to Wellington to meet with you, Ray, and we sat in your office and we talked, and we talked about William Goldman's book, yeah. You know, which was a real kind of influential book for both of us, you know, and there are a number of things we kind of connected on in that way. And then, of course, as I was saying earlier, there was the first time I met Tom, and Tom has become, you know, one of the most important people in my life. And you know, I can't imagine who I would be as a filmmaker without him, but I can't imagine who I'd be as a person without him. He's been such a huge and wonderful kind of part of my life and influence on me. And I think we met on the tribe, and we both were in a similar place at that point of being young and sort of desperate to do as good a job as we could and work as hard as we could. And when I think one of the things we saw in each other that was a connection that led to us, you know, making all the movies that we've made together and having our company together, is we both saw how hard the other one was prepared to work and how driven and dedicated we both were. And that really matters, you know, and then we got to know each other and saw the integrity, I think, that in each other, that was, as you say, such a crucial thing, because making a movie or making, you know, this kind of a TV series or these kind of ventures, it's such a huge amount of work. And I kind of feel like I wouldn't want to share that with someone that I didn't feel a great admiration for as a person. I think it becomes, as you know, it becomes like a family. And so, you know, that's, as I say, for me, there's all these kind of sort of such strong memories and influential parts of my life that I really do connect back to doing the tribe and first coming into it. And, you know, it felt so exciting at the time. I remember that.
Very special. I often say, James, that, you know, that Cloud Nine, the tribe particularly, was like a family, is like a family. I mean, it is like a tribe within a tribe, and like, yeah. You know, and not see each other for a while, and you pick up, and it's like you pick up from yesterday, you know. And partly, I think, because everybody involved, without exception, you know, we're all very talented people, but very nice people, very good human beings, very passionate, with great integrity, with, you know, and going to, Tom was saying he found meditation, and it's interesting and it's lovely to hear how you speak about each other, where you've both influenced each other so much. But I mean, Tom found his meditation from you, I hear. Vipassana meditation, is that right? I
mean, yeah, Vipassana, that's right. Yeah, it's like you go along for 10 days and you don't speak and you don't make eye contact with anyone and you just meditate, and it's in this kind of beautiful environment. And it's really hard. It's one of the hardest things that that I've done, as far as especially the first time when I didn't know how to meditate at all and I just kind of went along. But it's a really kind of powerful thing. And so Tom had meditated before that, but there was a point where I think I for quite a while I'd been encouraging him to go along to that, and then at a certain point, because Tom's such an exceptionally hard worker. I mean, he's just one of those people that, you know, gives it, what if he's working on something, he gives it every ounce of his being, but that means it's incredibly stressful. And so I was always encouraging him to go along, and then he did, you know, and he went along and he's done it a bunch now. And I think it's, you know, one of those.
How did you find, did you feel the need to, how did that come about in your own life? Who switched you onto it and why did you do it? Were you needing something? Were you?
I was in the middle of shooting Power Rangers, and I think I was at this point where I was, you know, probably not getting from acting what I, you know, had gotten, or I think at that point I was really sort of beginning to shift out of acting and into wanting to make films, but I was sort of working long hours and trying to probably do too much and getting a bit burned out. And and then I developed this like nodules on my throat, because like from strains, from throat strain, because I was also singing in a band at the time and just kind of trying to do a whole bunch of too much stuff really. And we reached this point where it was over Christmas and New Year's, we had this 2-week break, and I was like, I've got to somehow just fix myself. And a very, very close friend of mine who's always been into yoga and meditation, these sort of things, I was saying to him, I don't know what to do, but with this 2-week break, I've got to do something to just really, you know, heal. And he basically didn't really tell me anything. He just went, okay, pack your bags and come with me, and we're going away, and we'll be back in 10 days. I didn't really know anything beyond that. But I was kind of like, all right, I'm up for it. Let's do this. So I just packed some bags and I jumped in the car with him, and we drove up to Kokopakopa, this beautiful kind of forest place that's, you know, pretty uninhabited. And then there's this Vipassana kind of hall and area there. And it's sort of loosely kind of has this Buddhist element to it, but it's sort of not religious. It's very much just, it's about the meditation and about sort of, you know, listening to yourself and quietening your mind and these kind of things. And I went in, and I remember the first 4 or 5 days, I found it extremely hard because you have to sit still for 11 hours a day. And my knees were sore and my back was sore and I couldn't meditate. And I remember every time I would open my eyes and look around, everyone else looks like this Buddha, sort of like they're just perfectly in this sort of meditating, like, you know, as if they've done it forever. And I'm just like, it's not working. And of course it's over Christmas and New Year's as well. So I'm like feeling like, what am I doing here when I, you know, should be back for Christmas with family and friends and New Year's. But after about the fifth day, it suddenly just, something clicked, and I meditated properly for the first time, and it was such an incredible experience. And it sort of, everything kind of shifted after that. And it's funny because I don't at the moment meditate every day. I mean, trying to do that with two young children would be impossible almost in the same house. And, you know, it's like, but it's just trying to learn how to, again, as I say, I think trying to be kind to yourself and just take the pressure off yourself a bit. Cause I think especially in today's world and for a lot of young people that, you know, there's a lot of pressure and people put a lot of pressure on themselves. And there's this sort of feeling of anxiety that's very easy to slip into. And I think, you know, things like that, they can be helpful tools to sort of just try and teach you how to be a little more relaxed and to feel a little more content in your own mind and in your own world. And I think those lessons apply to a lot of stuff we were talking about earlier, which was, again, if you're trying to do something creative, and if it's writing or acting or whatever it is, you know, doing it because you love it and because it's actually, you learn about yourself through it, and it's about the journey of that. It's not, it, you know, I think it's important to not make the focus about success. That can come, and that can often be a nice thing if it comes, but it's never as nice as what you get, just you as a human being sitting alone with your craft, or sharing your craft with someone else, or feeling like you're learning and getting better at it, or learning more about yourself. Those are the greatest kind of gifts that you get from it. And everything else is just sort of a bonus.
I think that's good advice, James. It's interesting. There's a wonderful philosopher called Dag Hammarskjöld. And in his book called Markings, he says, never measure the heights of a mountain till you reach the top, then you will see how low it is. And that's an interesting philosophical thing, because whether you're wanting to be a director or an actor or a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, I mean, a lot of our cast, James, you know, they went off to be a lawyer, and they weren't happy. And really, I mean, thematically, if you live your life trying to be what others expect you to be, you'll never be free. And you've got to be true to yourself, hey, to get that happiness. And the Power Rangers are a very big franchise, and you're in the Power Rangers. You had a big role in the Power Rangers, and clearly very successful, but you felt this emptiness, I suppose, and the need for something else. And I think, you know, we all do that in this kind of fast-paced material world, you know, and probably this COVID is tragic, and my heart, as yours, everybody's, will ache for those who are grieving and who've lost loved ones, and people unemployed and fiscal. But in some ways, it's a stop button, is it, James? You know, to sit and reflect perhaps on what is important, and to readjust, I think, you know, and to, as you say, the stresses and the pressures and success and mortgages and status and this and that, you know, where if we can just slow down to the speed of life and reassess what we want to do and what will make
that's right. That's right. And as I say, I think such a, you know, big part of that is stopping and just listening to who you are, to yourself. And some of the most incredible people that I've ever met in my life are the people that aren't, it's not necessarily the ones that have been the most successful, but it's the people that they've sort of, they know themselves to an incredible degree. And that means, again, it's like knowing yourself and not judging yourself or beating yourself up about that, but kind of almost in a loving way going, okay, this is who I am. And I think, you know, look, that probably applies in a way when, you know, for me, when I was like, as an actor, and I did a lot of work as an actor, but, you know, there was a part of me that sort of just didn't ever feel entirely comfortable and it sort of sounds like it's a negative, but it's really not. It's kind of, I really enjoyed parts of it, but there were often times where I didn't want to kind of have a camera on me. Like, I didn't want to be.
Well, but that's what's terrific, James. You're comfortable in your skin. You know what you want. And that's very important, because unless you know, it's like a roadmap. If you don't know where you're going, you're never going to get there. And I think it is. It's like, like they say, know yourself, you know. And
yeah, exactly. And exactly.
That's terrific. That.
But, it, you know, it's, I do want to say as well, just on, when we were talking about the tribe, you know, it must have been for you such a wonderful thing to, you know, to have created such a rich and incredible world that's just so vibrant and full of life and so creative in the different, you know, sort of subcultures within it. And, you know, it's such a wonderful world that you created, right?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And I mean, it is. It's something that's very special. And I mean, I'm one person. I mean, the team at Cloud Nine and the cast and the crew and everybody that worked on it, I'm very proud of all of you and very touched. It is very special. It's something I tried patience and persistence to get the tribe away for years and years and years, James, and nobody could see it. But I, being an ex-hippie, wanted to really, you know, for young people, you know, I cared about what world were our children, your children inhabit, and to not to sanitize the world, you know, but
yeah,
that's hope, that's positive and aspirational. And I guess like me being an ex-hippie, you know, trying to build people. And it's very relevant now with climate change and ecology and our Mother Earth. And so the themes that we explored, you know, everything from bulimia to teenage pregnancy, suicide, alcoholism, all of that, but love, you know, and yeah, and it's resonated. And we were talking, James, how amazing it is, the loyalty and devotion to the fan base, which is, again, it's on our 20th anniversary there, tremendous. But the tribe has been like a friend to them, really, and they've grown up with it, and now their children are watching it. And it's very, very special and very humbling and very, 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 very lovely. So, James, I've got some questions, and I'm
always here, yes.
And all the fans are going to be mad at me for hogging you to myself, so bear with me.
Look, I'm all good for time, so...
Well, that's good. So this is now from Nate Emar Perez Riviera. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. Good morning, Nate Emar. Hi. If you could choose, James, a tribe to be part of right now in this quarantine, which one would it be? Technos, Mole Rats, Eco Tribe, or another? Sending love from Puerto Rico. Stay safe, and keeping the dream alive. So what would you be, a mole rat? Would you be an eco? Would you go into the woods? Techno? What do you think, James?
That's awesome. You know what? It's like, I think I would have said, the mole rats, because they, I guess it feels like there's that, a lot of the heart of the show kind of is with them. And I guess I felt like I knew those characters the most in a way, even though like Jay came in and the technos, it sort of, I don't know, it quickly wasn't working there. And I think my character quite quickly was with the Morats. And so that really felt like they felt like the people that I was kind of most connected to. But in saying that, the eco sort of tribe thing as well, I think I definitely love the idea of sort of being in nature as much as possible and that sort of aspect of it. And I really think that, you know, it's almost like, I guess the Morats, there's an urban aspect to them. And then with the eco kind of sort of environment aspect, that's kind of what the world needs, right? Is sort of more of a sort of living in nature. So I'd be torn. I'd probably go with the eco kind of tribe, I think.
Thank you for that. Well done. I've got one now, James from George Jones. Good morning, George. My question, please, was what was your first memory, James, of being on set as your new character, Jay? And had you seen or heard of the show before you started?
Right. Yeah. Wow. Cool. Thank you for the question. My first memory of being on set. You know, I think my first memory is doing a scene with Meryl, who was Ebony, and we were in one of the techno offices, I think. And here's the hilarious thing. I have this memory of worrying about whether I had good enough posture for the scene, because the techno costume was so tight. It was that kind of black lycra thing. And I remember feeling like, gosh, I better like stand up straight wearing this thing, or I'll look like I'm kind of, you know, hunched over and stepping around. But the funny thing is, Meryl, for all her wonderful attributes, is not incredibly tall. And so when I was playing, and I had these boots that gave me like a 2-inch lift, and I'm already kind of, I think I'm probably close to 6'2". So I'm just towering over Meryl, and we're playing this scene opposite each other, and I'm like trying to make sure I'm not like hunching over. So it's such a ridiculous memory, but that really is probably one of the things I first remember. And I think it was also the director. I can't remember who was directing it, but they might have told me I needed to, that I was like hunched over looking at it. I needed to stand up straight more. And so I think the next take I did, I stood up ridiculously straight, like just as if like I'm kind of got a rod up my back, which looked completely unnatural and wasn't right either. But that might be the take that ended up in the show from memory. So that's a kind of bizarre first memory. And I'd heard of the show and I'd seen bits of it, but I remember it just kind of before I did it, and it seemed like this amazing, I mean, just the visuals of the show were always so incredible. I remember very distinctly the visuals of seeing Zoot, Danny, you know, up on the car driving around, and you know, Ebony, and these kind of very striking, creative, kind of colorful looks. But I remember I watched a bunch of it for the first time in your office, Ray, when I came down to Wellington, and you really kind of played me quite a bit on the TV that you had in your office, and I remember just being riveted watching it.
Yeah, nice. And then it's interesting, Jim. I didn't realize that you sing. Isn't that weird? I didn't know that. And so next time you're down at the Vineyard, I've got to get my guitar out and I've got to. What kind of song? I mean, what kind of music are you into when you said you were not with a group? I mean,
well, funnily enough, so singing was the thing that I always did first, really, in a way. And as I said, that's what sort of got me into acting, was because I could sing. And so I did a lot of school musicals. And then when I started playing in bands, the funny thing as well, Ray, we should definitely get the guitars out, because I actually am probably more of a guitar player than a singer. I've played guitar for 24 years now. And I was a very, very kind of devoted to guitar for quite a long time. But it was very much blues rock was always the style that I was most into. So I played in a bunch of bands in New Zealand. And then when I lived in LA, I played in three different bands there. And really, you know, I kind of got to have a cool, the sort of fun musical experience. One of the bands I was in, the Pistol Whips, which was a three piece. It was myself, guitar and singing, and then a Raz, I'm a bass player, and then Jenny, a drummer. And we kind of we played at the Viper Room, and we got songs on the radio, and we toured California, and you know, really kind of got to do that for a while, and that was great fun. But like everything, you know, it was hard work as well.
Yeah, do you still play the guitar these days, James? Do you have a guitar at home? You strum to still do.
You know, I do. I've got. My wife feels I have too many guitars, and she's probably right. You know, I don't play as much as I used to. I've got a band that I play in, really, but it's just a bunch of like a few friends who've played for a long time, and we've played together on and off over the years. And every now and then we just get together and we jam. And it's I feel very, very lucky to be able to kind of, to have played an instrument and be able to just kind of go along and for a few hours just play. And it's a very kind of, it's almost like a meditation, I guess. And I've got a couple of guitars in my office that I pick up every now and then and just kind of jam along to some music on the radio or something, but it's not something I do as much these days. But I'm, you know, me and Tom also, because Tom is very musical. And so we've kind of played together a number of times, and that's been great fun as well.
No, he's a good rapper, old Tom. He's a good
yes.
Yeah, we'll have to have some sessions, and I might get you to, because we might be doing some more tribe music. And it's interesting, James, you were saying about the costumes and the aesthetic of the tribe, and which I think was within the palette, was something I was really keen on, because, you know, I'm very much into indigenous cultures, and I loved the all feathers and you know, like scavenging fashions, and like, yeah, it's almost like a guard, you know, and Summertide Sands look and the hair and the makeup and,
yeah.
And what, and I'm going to reveal something right now that nobody knows, okay? Each marking means something, okay? And right. Each marking. And I mean, I had worked out in my head this universe, this land, this world, and even the music of the Abbey Messiah means something. The lyrics, who was the Abbey Messiah? What is the Abbey Messiah? Very, very interesting. So Ebony, some of her markings in season one foretells the Abbey Messiah.
Wow.
It's very, very interesting. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, so there's a lot of trivia. So some of the, I'll tease some of the fans. You'll have to stay tuned. And maybe me and Tom and James over a couple of Pinot Noirs and for Tom. Yeah. A bunch of Earl Grey green tea, because he's on the wagon. We might talk about that. Who knows? In this world, it would be lovely to keep going on it. Now, I've got one from Ashna Reshma. Good morning, Ashna. Hi, James. Jay, we'd like to know if you wanted to take note of which other tribe would you choose to be a part of. We've done that. But when I first saw the tribe, I thought you and Ved were real-life brothers because of the similarity. I suppose that's the blonde hair, James. The next thing I would like to know, if you have also read the tribe books, to know how the series ends. Lots of love from the Netherlands. Have a good day. So we obviously can't get too much into the books, James, for spoilers.
Sure.
You're not a blonde by night. You're not blonde.
No. No, I've never been blonde since. That was my one kind of outing as blonde. And I remember thinking it was really interesting, actually, because I'd never thought of that when I was auditioning for the role. And I remember when I went down and met with you and, you know, and then it was like, you're going to be peroxide blonde. And I was like, wow, all right, that's really something. Then of course Dan, who played Ved, who was my younger brother, I think that the blonde hair probably did really sort of add to the sort of similarity between us, but you know, there must have been more similarity than that as well for us to kind of play brothers. But I remember him as a, you know, young actor, and he was incredibly talented, that kid. He was so good in that role, and he really had such a kind of screen presence. And he was really tall as well, because he was young. He was quite a bit younger than I was, but we were about the same height. And he did a really great job with. I mean, I remember lots of actors actually in it thinking they were doing such a great job, you know, with these very kind of very distinct, quirky, different characters. I think of him, remember him fondly.
Yeah, no, I think it was tremendous. Very, very young talent, but very good talent. He's only 13 then, I think.
Just yeah, so young.
So James, I got one from Alexandra Sending, I think it is. Good morning, Alexandra. In your opinion, what has been the most surprising aspect of the tribe fandom that has endured? Any thoughts on that, James?
The most surprising aspect. I just think what's surprising to me, good surprising, is just how passionate and sustained the fan base has been for the show. I think that speaks volumes to the show you created, Ray. And I think that's a really remarkable thing, you know, that the show has meant so much in people's lives and been able to live on for so long like that, you know. And I think, again, it's, you know, it's a it's a challenging world at the best of times for everyone. And I think if there's something like, you know, the tribe that can, you know, really speak to people and give them, you know, a sort of a companion, I guess, through life, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, no, it's quite special that I've got a lot from a lot of different people asking the same things about your, like from Justin Michael. Good morning, Justin. Also from Kelly Morales. It's all about, do you have Instagram? Will you ever have social media? This type of thing. Will you ever get onto it, or you're not?
Yeah, I mean, I should probably apologize to everyone for being so useless at being a at being kind of in any kind of social media capacity, or probably I'm not, you know, I don't really do a lot of interviews or sort of put myself out there that much, and I think it's sort of, I guess what I was saying earlier, I enjoy is, you know, having a kind of meaningful conversation with someone like we're doing now, that's sort of that feels very real and very genuine, and that hopefully you can kind of connect with people in that way. But what I'm not really the type of person for is the more kind of social media side, where it's like, I guess I'm just quite private in that sense. So, and again, it's not sort of, it's nothing more than, I guess, just that's how I seem to. I mean, I can tell you one of the reasons I'm not on Twitter is because I feel like any moment that I would be sitting there trying to think of what to tweet would be a moment I wasn't thinking about what I should write in a script that I'm working on. And I don't have the brain capacity to do both. You know, I would be sort of worried about putting any, and that sort of applies to any of those social media things, Instagram or whatever. I kind of, but a lot of actors that I work with, you know, they are very active on those things, and I think it's great, you know, that they can do that, and I think a lot of people get a lot out of that. You know, but I guess the most I could say is that each time I make a film or I have something come out that I'm sort of will then be part of, promoting, I'm always interested in having, you know, any kind of conversation that might be of any interest to anyone.
Interesting thing, social media or technology, and again, that's something 20 years ago that we explored in seasons 4 and 5, the responsibility of technology and with virtual reality and the paradise and the addictions. And it was a bit of ahead of its time, James, wasn't it, in some ways? But
yeah, I think your show was ahead of its time in a lot of ways.
And my worry, you know, is, I mean, I embrace technology and I love technology and that, but I, you know, I'm always nagging my kids and more particularly my grandchildren. It just don't reduce things to sound bites, you know? I mean, to have meaningful conversations. Yeah. And that's what is, like, I think it's very important. Everything is instant and fast and, you know, like so many, 20 characters or, you know, and that's not good. And it's and so much information, which is good to have readily available, but in days like now with all the speculation and that, where you can become polluted by fast food news, some fake, some real, some speculative. Yeah, yeah. And it causes a lot of mental health issues, I think.
You've got to be very careful with it. That's right. I think you do have to be very careful. And I think also it's like, you know, sort of Tom likes social media more than I do, for example. And he gets he gets, you know, I don't know how prolific he is with it, but he gets more out of it. But I think the one thing I also, like you say, it's, you got to be careful of not trying to reduce life into sound bites. And also the other thing I think to be careful of with social media is that it can very easily, you've got to be so careful not to get caught up in comparing yourself to other people too much, because I don't think there's anything positive that can really come out of that. I think that, you know, again, it's that thing of sort of learning about yourself and who you are and not trying to be someone else or feeling like you should be someone else. And I think one of the things that with social media is it can probably be very easy to compare yourself to others, because you're constantly being inundated with other people's lives, I guess, and a version of it that they want to put out there. And so that's the one thing I think, you know, it's probably just moderating that, or just making sure that you balance it with your own time with yourself and, you know, doing other things that are kind of good for you. But, you know, I wouldn't want to try and tell anyone not to use it. That would sound pretty ridiculous. I'm probably more out of step with the world. Well, we are, Ray, maybe. I'm not sure how active you are on it. But
I think it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people that are using it are coming to the realization where they long for something more. I mean, it's, you know, if it works, use it. If it doesn't, but just... as you say, it's nice to not have have some other dimensions, really. That so, James, I've got one from Bibis World. This is from our Instagram account. Speaking of social media, good morning, Bibis World. Is broccoli still your favorite vegetable? I remember with the German The Tribe magazine where you stated it, and it seems like this stayed in my mind. So you're still a vegetarian, James?
I am still a vegetarian, yeah. So I've been one since I was 4 years old, and I, you know, look, I've been doing it so long. I couldn't even imagine it. It's not something I need to think about. And you know what? Broccoli is, I love broccoli. It could definitely be up there, as one of my favorite foods. It's so funny that just thinking about that, because again, that's an interview question that I've sort of answered. And I remember being younger and with every interview, again, sort of feeling like she's sort of terrified of like, what's the thing, you know, like you feel this pressure of what should you say? You know, what's the kind of, and I remember getting sort of really, this is another memory I have with the Tribe, of being really sort of stressed out about this, because we were doing this interview and we were in the cast green room, and one of the questions was, what movie best represents your life? And I wanted to say Dazed and Confused, right? Because it just feels like such a great answer. Yeah. But Beth Allen, who was sitting next to me, she already had that. So I was like, I've got to come up with something else. And I couldn't think of any movie. And there was the poster, for whatever reason, there was the poster on the green room wall of the Mel Gibson movie, What Women Want. And I went, oh, I'll just write that. That sounds funny. And then I remember afterwards, and I read it and I saw it published, and I felt so mortified, because it sounded so kind of arrogant and like, you know, just reading it in print. I think I'd even tried to write a like winking smiley face of like, I'm not taking myself this seriously. I'm not taking myself seriously when I say this, but that didn't translate at all in the printed version. And it was a real lesson for me of, cause I wasn't very experienced at all of doing interviews. And I remember that thing of feeling like, say something witty or something funny or whatever, but going, God, really actually be careful of what you say. Cause once you say something, it's out there and you can't take it back. And that just, I remember for months, even maybe even like years afterwards, just cringing every time I thought of that answer that I'd given. And that, so it was like, so I had a lot of those sort of experiences with the Tribe, as I say, being the first real kind of lead role in a show, and actually people being interested in wanting to hear what you think and learning how to deal with that.
Isn't that interesting that I've got one from Courtney Love. Good morning, Courtney. The interview I've been waiting for. I randomly stumbled upon the tribe when I was on season 4 in the States on a channel called Wham. And I saw this beautiful face and was hooked ever since. How was it being the Red Power Ranger and working with fellow tribe members? Who do you feel like was Jay's true companion? If Ebony wasn't so paranoid, do you think the relationship would have remained? What was it like to keep bleaching her hair? Thank you for giving us Jay, the soldier, the moral compass, the believer. Keep the dream alive. That's an interesting. So with the Power Rangers, I mean, so you were the Red Power Ranger, James.
Yeah.
And wasn't Tom a Power Ranger as well?
Yeah, well, he was in it. Yeah, he played a reporter character, like a journalist. It was great doing that show with him because, you know, we really just continued to get closer as friends. And I think at that point, working on another show together, it really felt like we were kind of being thrown together in life in a way. And so that was really fun.
James, was it shot in New Zealand, the Power Ranger?
It was, yeah. It was fun. It was like I got to do lots of fight scenes and, you know, jump around and kind of, it was, again, I think at that point in life, I was still figuring myself out and in a sense of what I wanted to do, you know, longer term in life. And I think it was a show that, it sounds bizarre, but it's given how sort of famous that show is around the world, but I actually didn't really know that much about it. I'd never seen it because it didn't really play here in New Zealand. So it was kind of, but it was this sort of US show that was shooting here. And funnily enough, they actually, because, you know, Ray, I did 2 seasons of The Tribe, season 4 and season 5, and they actually offered me the role, the Red Power Ranger role, after season 4. To go and do it, and I turned it down to come back and do season 5 of The Tribe.
Good, James, that's
yeah. So then after I finished season 5, and then I think, you know, we kind of the show sort of finished for us at that point, and they'd shot the previous season with a different actor, and so but they would use different actors each season. So then they kind of offered it to me again, and so I sort of did it that time, but it was kind of, it was funny because, as I say, I didn't really know much about, like, I hadn't seen it, and I kind of, it was a lot bigger than I probably overseas than I realized. And I funnily enough, I remember having a similar experience with The Tribe where, you know, I don't think I had any idea of the fan base that it had until we went overseas on that tour, that kind of 5-week trip. And I'll never forget what it was like when we landed in Germany and we were going through customs, and I remember hearing this chanting sound coming from out in the airport, and I genuinely was like, there must be a kind of pop band or something here that chanting is for. And then we walked through customs and I have another really funny memory leading up to this moment. We arrived in Germany, and then we were walking as a group, and I had this, and Germany felt quite intimidating in some ways coming from New Zealand, where we don't really have guns and stuff, not a lot. And in Germany, I remember arriving, and there were police in the airport with guns, like, and armed police, and I was like, wow, that's quite hardcore. And I was looking at one of these guys, and then he looked at me, and he was staring at me and didn't look happy. And then he suddenly just came, like, walking really fast towards me, and I was like, oh my god, what's happening? And he started speaking in German, which I couldn't speak. And it was quite aggressive. It was quite, like, confronting. And I remember just being, I had no idea what was going on. And then finally someone translated for me that he'd recognized me from The Tribe. And He was asking for me to autograph something for his daughter.
Isn't that amazing?
And I remember being like, just like, I will do whatever you want so long as you don't shoot me. Like, you know, so I'm like shakily like, oh, what a relief. Like, so I signed this thing for him and gave that. And then, as I say, then I kind of caught up with the others and we were going through customs. I heard this chanting and I thought, oh, there must be this pop band. And then we walked through and there were just, I don't know how many, hundreds of people waiting in the terminal for us to come out.
Yes.
And I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it because I just had no idea in a way, like that scale. And that was the beginning. And we got kind of thronged and it was actually almost a moment of like, oh my, like this is almost intimidating because I'm getting separated from, I don't know what, you know. And then that was the beginning of that trip of everywhere we went, just realizing, you know, just the amount of people and the passion for the show and for the characters. And I think Jay at that point, you know, I was a new character, you know, so there were the kind of characters that were even sort of bigger stars in a way of the like Beth, Amber and Michael Wesley Smith and a bunch of others. But, you know, it was a really kind of eye-opening experience. And then, sorry, I've forgotten the other part of the question was
about Ebony, I think, who
she was. Oh, it was Jay's. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's an interesting question. And to be honest, there was a certain point, I think, in season 5 where I actually, like, I couldn't keep up with all the different sort of characters that Jay was kind of in relationships with, because it was like initially it was Ebony and then it was Amber with Beth and then there was Tony Preble. And I feel like that's not, I can't answer that. I think, you know, people that have watched it might have a better answer than I do of who Jay was. Maybe, I guess I remember shooting a very kind of very kind of moving, beautiful sort of scene with Amber, with Beth, and we were out in the countryside together, and we were kind of on the run, and it felt like there was a kind of a specialness between them, you know, in that moment. So maybe that, but I feel like that's that, you know, yeah, I guess each of them they had their own moment.
That's a good answer, James. I think you're right that they're, I mean, it's for the actors, the tribal fans will know, have to just interpret what the writers have written or what the storylines are. And it's interesting, whatever the listeners will prefer, that if Jay had ended up with Amber or with Ebony or whatever, you know, that it's good, the interpretation. It's interesting, James. I'm just reading one on Instagram from 619 Susie. Hi, James. And you've answered this, but how did you feel back in 2003 on the European tour when you came to Berlin and the tour was packed with thousands of fans? I met you and it was fantastic. And I was so nervous. Love and kisses from Germany. So she still remembers that, James, to this day. That's 17 years ago.
Wow, that's awesome.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, we tend to forget. You know, but that they don't forget. Susie doesn't forget that she met you in a shop, and there's just so many.
I remember meeting like so many amazing fans on that tour. I do remember, it was I guess there's something, it's a special connection that I think, you know, sort of people have, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think it's a beautiful thing that this show has that kind of sort of dedicated fan base.
Yeah. And James, I've got a lovely one on YouTube from, again, very similar to the theme, from Jordy Cordier. Good morning, Jordy. This is, hello, James and Ray. I met James at the airport of Amsterdam twice, and I wonder what was his best memory of the tour, which you've described. But Jordi is saying, James made an everlasting impression as I was only 13 or 14 years old. And that's amazing, James. And that's what I think is so special, because, and as the Tribe fans are, they're very loyal and they'll follow, no doubt with great interest, your career. And every huge success, James, I know is going to come your way as a writer and as a director, because, you know, having seen what you did with The Dark Horse, the only way is up. You're destined to do some great things, and your best days are yet to come, you know. And I would be honored to work with you in a heartbeat at any time again. I'd love you to act, but
the most that I might do at some point is sort of, you know, play a small role in something I direct. But each time I've done it, I've always just longed to be back behind the camera. But it's funny, because I will say, you know, in that regard, you know, if anyone sort of, and I understand that thing of, you know, why don't you sort of act more, or, you know, it's always interesting seeing someone in front of the camera as an actor, and you really can kind of build a connection with them that way. But there is something so immensely personal and about a film that you've, or a show that you've made as well, if you've written it, you know, and or directed it, it's such a personal thing that I feel like you really are getting to know that person in an even deeper way, in a sense, from their voice in that, you know, through that. But I can play a cameo in something every now and then.
I think like, watch this space. Who knows what the future will hold? But, you know, whatever happens, you know, James, you must all follow his career. James has got some exciting things in the pipeline coming up, and I know that, and Tom as well. So, James, I mean, we're way over our hour, so I'm grateful for you extending that a bit, and I don't want to dominate your time, but is there anything you'd like to say to the fans, James, as we approach the 20th, or we're on the 20th anniversary, just and about the COVID thing, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think in a way I just kind of would want to, through this sort of, through this podcast, would have just kind of give everyone a big hug, I guess, and sort of say to everyone to try and sort of stay positive and stay kind, and be kind to each other, and be kind to yourself, and sort of keep faith in the positive in the world. And in, you know, I feel like the world is and has been going through a pretty turbulent time, and I think there can be a lot of negativity out there, but and it's easy to feel like that's all that's out there at times, but it's, you know, it's not. And I think there's so much that's beautiful and that's worth staying hopeful for. And I think that ultimately you also have to look inwards and into yourself to find that, and just try and live a life that you will sort of, that will make you happy, you know, whatever that thing is. And that's the best you can do. And I think, I think it's something I feel privileged to be able to share that message with people in a way. And I feel lucky that I've sort of lived a life so far that means that, you know, anything I say is even of sort of interest in that sense. But I do wish everyone out there, you know, the absolute best. And I think just, you know, yeah, be happy and be kind, and that's the best we can do.
That's lovely advice, James, and I think that's a lovely lovely thought, actually, and I endorse exactly the same to all our tribal brothers and sisters out there, and for both James and I know we're both quite humbled that you've been with this series for so long, and indeed are still are there, and as James, you said it very well, James, it's the mere fact that there's interest is so touching, isn't it, really? It's quite amazing. And so so you must keep the dream alive, whatever that is. And James will be doing his talents, and you'll get to know him better through his work as a director and a writer. And Tom as well, where they've got some great things in the pipeline. And who knows, over a glass of Pinot, I might secretly record James singing and put on, on a future track album. I'll get my guitar out and I'll howl along with you, James.
That's right.
It's really, I mean, and on behalf of the tribal fan base, I'd like to thank you, James, for giving something back, really, for taking the time to speak this morning. I know it will mean a lot. It means a lot to me, but more importantly, it will mean a lot to the tribal brothers and sisters within our tribe fandom. And I'd like to send all our love and my love to you and your wife and your two lovely children, and continued success, and to keep happy. And I look forward to the next time I can get you on the vineyard for a bottle of Pinot, or more importantly, a couple of bottles.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's wonderful, and it's my pleasure, Ray, and my pleasure to speak with you again as well. It's
that's lovely. But well done, and you take good care, and lots of love to you, James, and we'll catch up very soon.
Sounds great.
All the very best.
Thanks Ray.
Bye bye now. Bye bye.
Bye.